Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is coming up with more cash for clunkers. That's the program launched just days ago. They pledged to give buyers up to $4,500 for their gas guzzlers to help purchase more efficient cars. Congress had approved $1 billion for the rebates, but the program was so successful it ran out of money in just a week. The White House said today the program will now continue at least through the weekend, and Congress will provide more funds. Bill Crowder is general manager at Signature Automotive Group in Benton Township in southwest Michigan. Bill, how's business been this week?
Fantastic. We've never seen results on an incentive program like this.
Like, how many have you sold?
We've sold in the last week about 60 vehicles. That's about, well, it's almost three times as many vehicles.
As you sell in a week. Wow.
Yes.
We understand yesterday alone, how many cars?
11.
Have you received the cash from the government? Tell us more about that process.
No, I have not received any cash payments at this point. The process is a little bit cumbersome. I think the biggest problem is the backlog that they have on processing the transactions. Typically, we're entering the transactions, but in periods throughout the day, the website runs slow, it'll crash, there's problems. We have to employ people to come in early morning hours or late evening hours to submit transactions just so that we can get them in.
Well, we understand, too, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, which is administering this program, hasn't approved or denied a single of your claims yet.
That's correct. The problem is that I don't know about any transaction that's there. It just says under review, so I don't know if it's good or bad.
Do you worry that maybe some of these cars that you've pledged to people and pledged that they will get the rebate that will help you deliver the new car, maybe you won't get it?
Well, certainly I worry, but it's a little bit limited because I feel that the program is structured right. We've done our job properly. There's no reason for denial. The federal government obviously is backing the program with this funding, so I would hope all in all we're made whole.
So you don't feel you're going to be left holding the bag?
Well, I am concerned, but I don't feel that in the end, based on the things that I've seen happen in the last 24 hours, that that's going to continue to be a concern. What I'm more concerned about today is how many more days we'll have of funding.
Well, we understand about 40,000 new vehicles have been officially purchased through the program. Dealers like yourself estimate another 200,000 have been sold in transactions that haven't yet been completed. The billion in the original plan was for about 250,000 cars, so as we can see, that's been used up. Remind us again, who's eligible?
Well, anybody that has a vehicle that's 25 years old or newer has a fuel economy of 18 miles per gallon or less. In order to receive a credit of $4,500 in an automobile, you have to improve your fuel economy by 10 miles per gallon. In a truck, you only have to improve your fuel economy by 5 miles per gallon to receive the maximum allowance.
So the program lowering pollution on the roads was also intended to boost car sales. You know, there have been some critics. The automotive industry site Edmunds.com told the Associated Press that in a three-month period, Americans already trade in 200,000 cars for new cars. And as we said, the initial bill provided funds for 250,000 cars. Sounds like it's going to go over that. And they're saying that's, you know, 50,000, maybe more increase. They say not that much. What do you think?
Well, I think, yes, it is a small percentage. But I will tell you this. My experience with the program is the people that I'm selling these vehicles to, I would have never have seen. There's, first of all, a survey that the government asks you to fill out with the Cash for Clunkers. We've asked all of our customers to fill it out. The indications that we're getting from them is they would not have been in this dealership to buy a car now if it weren't for this incentive. That's key. You know, the other thing that happens here is that if somebody just on the edge, this will put them over the edge. So that's why we've seen such a response to this, is because these are people that know a good value when they see it, number one. Number two, the buyer that we're seeing, very frugal. They use good common sense, and they are taking advantage of a program that is now available to them. Some of these clunkers, quite honestly, could drive for another year or two, I think.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Bill, because it sounds to us like, gee, you could take a really nice 2008 car and trade it in. It's not a clunker at all, but you could get that extra $4,500 and really upgrade your car, which isn't really helping people whose cars are dying out on the road, who
well,
even with a $4,500 couldn't afford a new car.
That doesn't apply, because here's why. You don't get the $4,500 and your trade-in value.
Meaning?
If you have a car that's worth $8,000 and you bring it in and the dealer appraises it, you're not eligible for the program, because why would you give your car away for $4,500 when the dealer's ready to give you $8,000?
Ah, so you don't get anything for the car that you bring in but the rebate.
That is correct. The person that's going to win in this case is a person that's driving a car that's worth $1,500 or $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000. Those are the types of cars we're seeing traded in.
That's Bill Crowder, General Manager at Signature Automotive Group in Southwest Michigan. They've been very busy this week because of the Cash for Clunkers program. Bill, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A UN report out today claims that between bombings by insurgents and airstrikes by U.S. and other forces, the number of civilians killed in Afghanistan has jumped 24% over last year, 48% over the year before, which makes it all the more remarkable that the ratings for a new television show have also been climbing, because Afghans face such a risk in watching and participating in the Afghan version of American Idol. It's called Afghan Star.
قبلای خود باد هستیم
بوده های روزی ازل قسمت کایم خونجیگری.
Some of the 2,000 contestants on last year's Afghan Star, which just wrapped up its fourth season and is a sensation in Afghanistan. The contestants are competing for a recording contract and small amount of money, but of course the stakes are much higher. As reviewer Ty Burr writes in the Boston Globe, nothing short of political and social freedom, gender equality, and the chance to heal a country 30 years under dictatorship. Afghans have a storied love of singing, but it was banned under the Taliban and only made legal again after the 2001 U.S. invasion. Afghan Star hoped to soar on that promise, and it has, but not without an undercurrent of real danger. Last year, the Islamic Council declared the show immoral. Participants have fled the country. The show's host was granted political asylum here in the U.S. The new documentary, Afghan Star, won both the director and the coveted audience award at the Sundance Film Festival. Director and producer Havana Marking joins us from the BBC studios in London. Havana, welcome.
Hi there.
Also joining us is Daoud Siddiqui, who was the show's presenter and director. He's now at his home in Springfield, Virginia. Daoud, welcome to you as well.
Hi, how are you? Thank you.
I'm fine. And we know that you felt more comfortable speaking through an interpreter, so we're going to welcome Saeed Zafar to do that as well. I wanted to ask you, Daoud, you know, as we see in the film, some Islamic clerics prayed for contestants to win. Others issued statements about your show, calling it immoral. Now, at one point in the film, you say the Taliban is finished. You predicted you'd win in this sort of fight over whether or not the show is moral. But now you've left the country. Is it in fact because the Taliban won? Is it not safe for you there anymore?
After the 9/11 happened and the invasion of Afghanistan and establishment of the new government in Afghanistan, people started to get very hopeful and everyone was excited about what was going on in Afghanistan. But after 2004 and 2005, the situation is getting worse and worse, and now it's the worst time since the invasion of Afghanistan. And you can see it through the media.
Well, in fact, Daoud, you and others say in the film that you had hoped that Afghan Star would pull Afghans together because the competitors and the viewers are from different ethnic groups in Afghanistan. I want to play another scene. Here, some producers of Afghan Star are talking about that possibility of the show bringing people together. Let's listen.
Herat, Mazar, Kunduz, Kandahar, Jalalabad. So it's not from one part. Afghanistan is different ethnics, Pashtun, Hazara, people from the north. These 30 years of war, all these internal fightings, even Kabul was distributed into 5-6. So it's like rare that a Pashtun supports an Hazara. And where in this show, a Pashtun does support an Hazara, says that he's the best. This might affect Afghanistan's national unity for the long term. There are many ways so you can persuade people to get together. Don't listen to others. Do what an Afghan wants to do.
Daoud, did you think that this would happen? And did it happen somewhat?
Bale, ba bishar iftikhar gustam mitanam ke
I'm very proud to say that, yes, the mission that we have in Afghanistan, that was to strengthening the unity between different ethnicities, was done. Of course, we were not like bringing up big people or politicians, but we were bringing only a singer out of many, many different ethnics and ethnical groups. And I'm very proud and happy to say that we have accomplished our mission.
Well, Havana Marking, I want to bring you in here. You tell a fascinating story. You take us across the country following these contestants. We see Afghans watching in, you know, little cafes and on rooftops, rigging up antennas to try to see the show. Just fascinating. Tell us more about your observations of the underlying social and political things that we see unfold in Afghanistan because of the show.
The show is having an amazing impact. And yes, as Dawood says, it's not a political show. It's not dealing with sort of great big giant issues with great big giant important people. But it is creating a space for young Afghans especially to sort of just get an idea that their world can be different, that people can be equal, that there can be freedom and there can be self-expression. I mean, people are coming to the auditions in droves, but they're also watching it in their millions. And I think that's very important to understand that. I mean, when you ask Dawood, has the Taliban won? No, the Taliban hasn't won, because actually the majority of people are listening and watching the show, and they're listening to music, and there is a change happening. The Taliban has the loudest, most violent voice, and so they're the people that we always hear all the time. But what I'm very proud that happens in our film is that I think we finally get a different opinion of what's happening there and a different view of Afghans and what they want from the future.
That's Havana Marking, producer of the new documentary Afghan Star. Here's another clip from her film. Now remember, Afghans vote for contestants through their cell phones, one vote per phone or SIM card. And producers of the show are marveling at how passionate Afghans are about that.
A rich guy from Kandahar bought 10,000 SIM cards for Lema, so he could do a campaign to SMS for her. And there's another guy who's going to do a campaign for Hamid Sakhizadeh, who's going to buy more than 10,000. That's what his plan is. And he's ready to sell his car for $6,000 right now if someone's ready to buy it and to buy SIM cards and vote for Hamid.
An Afghan wants to sell his car to buy SIM cards to vote for one of the contestants. It's a scene from the new film Afghan Star, and we also see young girls playing with dolls that represent the female contestants on the show. But as we'll hear, those female contestants run the most risk being in the show, as we'll hear after a break. Also later today, the steroid scandal gets some new asterisks. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the Afghan TV show Afghan Star and the documentary of the same name. The show is a test of Afghanistan's fragile democracy. The Islamic Council has ruled it immoral, and the host has taken refuge in the U.S. He's Dawood Siddiqui. He's been speaking with us through his interpreter. We're also speaking with Havana Marking, the film's director. And Havana, let's talk about the two female contestants on Afghan Star. One is Lima. She's more conservative, but still, she confesses she hid her music books from the Taliban as a child. The other is Satara, a free thinker who's emboldened as she marches toward the final rounds. But suddenly, she's voted off, after which she has that, you know, traditional last performance, in which she is both crushed and seems to be digesting that it's back to the reality of her conservative town for her. But at the same time, she's defiant. She begins dancing. Now, movie critic Ty Burr says it's the equivalent of Sinead O'Connor tearing up a picture of the Pope. Let's listen. Havana, could you please describe what happens in that moment? something happens to her. It's almost as if she's possessed.
Yeah, it is. It was an amazingly electric and extraordinary moment. And I was backstage and it was seeing her on this little tiny monitor backstage dancing. And as she dances, her headscarf slips. And there's a moment where she's kind of pointing at the camera and just singing with it to her complete heart's content. I mean, she really just lets go.
But she's dancing. How did people react? Because
that the extraordinary thing is, I mean, obviously, you know, music, if you have to think of it in relative terms, music was banned until, you know, 9 years ago or 8 years ago. Just listening to a music cassette could get you put into prison. So to perform music is one step on from that, you know, to perform music is a radical act, and to dance is one step too far, and people were absolutely shocked.
And we should say, it's not like she was dancing like Madonna. It was a very modest, almost a cha-cha, but you stood with people backstage, other contestants, who literally gasped.
People were absolutely shocked. It's not a question of how much she danced. The fact is that she danced. Men don't dance in public. Women don't dance in public there. It's completely shocking. It's a step too far for the majority of people there.
Even the other female contestant, Lima, who's from Kandahar, who is very conservative, said she just did not approve of this dancing.
Mm.
Ironically, it's Cetera initially that we worry for, and she becomes increasingly frightened of what's going to happen to her because she danced. It's Lima, who we understand now after the filming is over, is the one who's in a bit more trouble.
Yeah, Lima at the end of the show had to get special protection from the Kandahar's governor. It's never quite sure. We were never quite sure afterwards if she was being targeted because of what she'd done as a woman who'd been on stage, or if because she had publicly won some prize money and therefore was a sort of kidnapped ransom victim. And so you never knew if it was for the money or because of ideology.
It just underscores again, the stakes are a lot higher in Afghanistan when you go on
the show. There's no question. And everyone taking part, and the producers of the show, Daoud John, who's sitting there, you know, everyone is incredibly brave. There's no question.
Well, before we go back to Daoud, I want to just say again that Lima was the contestant who was the more conservative, didn't approve of Cetera dancing. She's the one who's under government protection now. Cetera, who we worried about quite a bit in the film, has actually made a recording of her music?
Yeah, she's released a few singles, but she's recording an album at the moment. She's done sort of video clips, and she has made an amazing life for herself. She's gone back to Kabul and is safe. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's safe as long as Kabul remains safe.
Daoud, here you are, because you didn't feel safe. You've taken refuge in Virginia. Is it some consolation that Cetera, who terrified us thinking what might happen to her, has actually seemed to rise above in Afghanistan?
At the beginning, when we started the show, for people of Afghanistan and for everyone in Afghanistan, it was just a musical show where people would come and do the contestant and sing a song and then go back. But after the documentary was released all over the world and inside Afghanistan, people really understood what actually is this show about. And Cetera, of course, she's now in Kabul, and she sings, and she's safe, and she's making a name for herself. But I was the person who was leading the whole group. And after the documentary was released, everyone in Afghanistan who is against the democratic process in Afghanistan is now against me after watching this documentary.
Yeah. Well, as we hear in the documentary, you've given other Afghans, especially young Afghans, their first taste of democracy because, as we said, they cast a vote with their cell phones for the show. And as a young Afghan watching in a cafe explains in the film, you've given him respite from politics and, as he says, misery or misery. Let's listen.
For Afghans, poor people. Afghanistan program is more important than politics. All of their bad strategies in politics bring misery for our people. You understand? So in this reason, most of people like fun programs, music, dislikes, things they like.
A scene from the new film Afghan Star. It's the story of the Afghan version of American Idol. We've been speaking with British filmmaker Havana Marking, joining us from the BBC in London. Havana, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We've also been speaking with Daoud Siddiqui through our interpreter, Syed Safar. Daoud, the show's presenter and director and producer, who's taken refuge in Springfield, Virginia because of some reaction to the show in some quarters in Afghanistan. Daoud, thank you so much for speaking to us as well.
Thank you so much for me also.
Oh, by the way, we should say, not only were you very brave in producing this program, but you did it on a wing and a prayer, hooking up this old television equipment, carting it across Afghanistan. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
Remember the public outcry earlier this year when it became known that executives at bailed-out AIG received millions of dollars in bonuses? Well, a new report from the New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo reveals that nearly 5,000 employees at bailed-out banks received more than $1 million each in bonuses last year. And those huge CEO bonuses are still being paid out. In fact, AIG has some in the pipeline. The report is timely because today House lawmakers are expected to pass a bill that supporters say will begin to rein in out-of-control CEO salaries in the future. The bill is called Say on Pay, and it gives shareholders at the country's biggest companies the right to an annual, though non-binding, vote on CEO pay. It also gives regulators the power to ban incentive perks. The bill faces an uncertain future in the Senate, and the White House has expressed some concern it may go too far, but others wanted more, like government caps on CEO salaries. Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank joins us. He's chair of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman Frank, you say on pay is a good first step. Why?
A large part of the problem is that some of these pay packages have been too high. Well, that's up to the shareholders. It's the shareholders' money, and we believe there'll be a restraint on that, but that's not the government setting the caps. That's the shareholders. On the other hand, here's where there's the public interest. A lot of these people had compensation schemes whereby if they took a big risk with the company's money and it paid off, they got extra. But if they took a big risk and the company lost money, they didn't lose anything.
Right.
The game was heads they won, tails they broke even.
So as you say, this new bill gives regulators the authority to prohibit some of these incentives, the stock options, the golden retirement parachutes.
Exactly. You mentioned AIG. It would say you don't get bonuses that you get whether you fail or succeed. So we explicitly are going to be having the SEC require what we call clawbacks, clauses in the compensation that will say, if you've got a compensation scheme that's based on a gamble paying off, and it turns out a year later that that gamble did not pay off, but you were given some money in the interim, you have to give it back.
The bill also calls for independent compensation committees. We know sometimes boards at big companies are all okaying each other's
exactly.
high salaries, so it goes that far. But I guess the criticism, if you want to characterize it as that, is, or the disappointment maybe, is that there are people who were looking for pay caps.
Look, if a company which is owned by the shareholders, if those shareholders want to pay a lot of money, I do think that's the shareholders' right. I believe you will see a moderation of pay when the shareholders are involved. But the other part of it is, from the public standpoint, the problem there is not so much the amount as the incentive it gives for people to take the kind of risks that got us into trouble. And that we do stop in a binding way.
The bill now has to go through the Senate. Do you think it
does? I think this time the Senate's going to do it. We passed the Say on Pay part in 2007. The Senate didn't act on it. But that was when the crisis was not yet there. Some of us were afraid of what was happening, but we couldn't point to the reality. I think, by the way, you're going to see a whole package of reform. We're going to tighten up regulation of derivatives. You're not going to see this wild speculative behavior. We're going to say that you can't engage in excessive leverage. That is, you can't be indebted 38 times as much as you have to pay off the debts. I think that we have a new climate now where the public understands. Again, it wasn't just their own money that they were losing. They were causing a terrible national and international crisis. So I believe this is going to be signed by the president.
Quick last question. This is going forward. Right now there is a sort of a compensation czar appointed by the Obama administration who's deciding about compensation right now at bailed out banks, for instance, whether or not AIG execs should get a huge $235 million bonus that they say is due them, but can't rein in any of the banks that paid back their bailout money, banks like Goldman Sachs, which some say went right back to the bad practices that got us in this mess and just paid themselves huge bonuses based on their most recent earnings.
That's what our bill does. That's exactly why we are passing this bill. The shareholders of Goldman Sachs will be able to vote. Look, Morgan Stanley, we're told, just decided to put 72% of its revenue into paying itself. Well, I don't think the shareholders are going to like that. They'll get to say whether they like it or not. Secondly, though, that's exactly why we are trying to get this bill into law. It deals with those institutions that have paid off the TARP because they'll be covered whether they're under the TARP or not.
Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Okay, love.
Okay, and still ahead today, polo on bicycles in London, really? And here in Boston, the wailing and gnashing of teeth begins again as two World Series championships are tainted by the steroid scandal. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now Sports Division. We go first to London, which is hosting the first ever European Hardcourt Bicycle Polo Championships this weekend. It's polo played on two wheels instead of four legs. The winners will play in the World Championships in Philadelphia in September. Who knew? The BBC's Tamsin Ford goes along for the ride.
It's a cold, wet evening in East London, but also the final chance for players to practice before the big event at the weekend.
Three, two, one, polo!
Hi, this is Mark. I'm from Paris. My polo player from Paris.
My name's Brendan. I'm on Team Bad, as in Brendan, Ada and Dave, and we're from London.
So it sounds like it's quite a cheap sport. You make your own bikes, pretty much, or you get a really old, battered one.
Yeah.
You make your own poles.
Yeah.
You don't pay for the courts.
Nope. You make everything yourself. I mean,
you have any trainers?
Probably the most expensive thing is balls. It's a very much a DIY sport. And if it's not a DIY sport, then somebody will help you do it for you.
5 minutes!
Can you show me one of these mallets?
Yeah, cool. It's simple. You take a ski pole, piece of PVC plastic tube, you know, and just drill it, put it together.
The older ski poles are the best thing.
Yes, nice one.
Bicycle polo has been around for more than 100 years, but hardcourt bike polo, thought of by many as its punk cousin, came about around 12 years ago. It originated on the west coast of America. A decade later, it spread to Europe and now seems to be getting more popular by the day.
Hi, I'm Roxy. I am the organiser of the European Hardcourt Bike Polo Championships.
2 minutes remaining.
Bike polo is really easy as long as you can ride a bike one-handed while carrying a mallet, while following a ball, well, five other players are doing exactly the same thing, and you don't hit anybody. Easy. It's easy.
Okay, so the top tips. I'm on my bike. I've got my mallet. I'm moving. There's a lot of rain.
And here, so come up. Steal the ball from me.
I'm
trying
you.
To pass you. Steal it. Yeah. You did it.
See, I don't even have any other team players against me, and I'm finding it hard.
Here, I'll go versus you.
1 minute.
I think one of the number one tips that you can give somebody at this stage is to try to look up. Don't be constantly staring at the ball, because that puts your focus on the ground, which is no good. Back, yeah, there you go. There, that's awesome.
Hardcourt bike polo is still relatively new. There are no professional players, but associations and federations are quickly beginning to pop up around the world. After the Euros this weekend, it's time to go stateside for the World Championships in Philadelphia next month.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Game.
That report from the BBC's Tamsin Ford in London.
It's unfortunate because he's done such a great job for the Red Sox for the last 9 years.
There's no question that he's a target. As a popular player, the Red Sox are enemies to the evil empires.
Boston Red Sox fans reacting to news that their beloved slugger David Ortiz, Big Papi, is on the list of players who tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs in 2003. And it gets worse. Former Red Sox great Manny Ramirez is on the list, too. As every fan knows, this was 1 year before their lives changed forever. The seas parted, and the Red Sox won the World Series for the first time in 86 years, largely on the strength of the Ortiz and Ramirez bats. Boston Globe sports writer Dan Shaughnessy joins us. Dan, your first words today: David Ortiz lied to you. His entire Red Sox career is a lie. Dan, how do you really feel about this?
Well, it's unfortunate. I mean, the timeline's not good for David on this, and the fact that there's a positive test for him in 2003, right when his career turns around. And, of course, the Red Sox universe changed forever in 2004 when they finally won, and it's the big power guys on that team, Manny and David, were cheating in 03.
You say that championship in 2004, as well as the 2007, tainted forever?
Everything's tainted in baseball the last 15 years now, the way we're looking at it. But if you're going to challenge the Barry Bonds home run record beating Hank Aaron, and you're going to challenge Mark McGwire hitting 70 home runs in 1998 and say those things are tainted, then a team championship where your 3 and 4 hitters were caught cheating in 03 is certainly tainted. What it amounts to is that, you know, our cheaters are better than your cheaters, which is not exactly the kind of fuzzy way to think about it.
Right. Well, what has Ortiz said about the news?
He said he was blindsided by the report before the game. And again, we don't know whether these guys knew when they tested in 03 that they were positive, but they certainly didn't think it was going to come out, and that was a condition of the testing.
Well, in spring training this year, Ortiz told reporters that players who tested positive for steroids should be suspended for an entire season. But as we said, it was also revealed yesterday that Manny Ramirez was on the 2003 list, and we're reminded that he left the Sox for the Dodgers last fall when he tested for another non-steroid bodybuilding drug, and he recently served a 50-game suspension because of that. So what happens to players if they surface on the 2003 list?
Manny's suspension in the spring was because he got caught in 2009, and the rules are in place now. There is testing, and you pay penalties when you're caught. In 03, there were no rules. Major League Baseball Players Association had blocked testing as a civil liberties issue. So what you had was they agreed to let all players be tested in 03 under the condition it would be anonymous with no punishment. We just need to know the extent of the problem. 104 guys turned up positive. Moving forward, they said, this tells us there is a problem and we will now have testing and punishments, etc. But that list of 104 was never supposed to be revealed. The first name to come out was Alex Rodriguez. There's still 100 guys that will probably come out of that someday. It's like your grand jury testimony being leaked. It's illegal. It shouldn't happen. But the larger issue, of course, for fans is, oh, my gosh, these guys did it, and they're tainted.
Another question that's raised is, we understand the Players Association, which, as you said, cooperated with the 2003 testing, knew the list. Should they have told players?
We're assuming that they knew the list. We're assuming that they told players. What we can't figure out is why they didn't destroy the list, like Nixon should have burned the tapes. I mean, the fact that those names were able to get out there and that lawyers have them or there's people out there with those names, it's information that was supposed to be impounded and just go away. But that's why you're not seeing penalties for these guys now. It's just the public relations image and that stuff that they're suffering for.
Meanwhile, Dan, do fans, obviously they're crestfallen. We know that. We're hearing that here in Boston. We've gotten back into our wailing mode. But do fans just assume that that's the game from here on out?
I think when the records are smashed, fans really care. When they see Roger Maris and Hank Aaron taken out of the books and they think, oh, guy's cheating, nobody likes that. If you go to the Olympics, it's kind of important. If a guy's running the 100-yard dash in 6 seconds and he's on stuff, well, that's not good. The Olympics have imposed testing more than any other sport because it's individual records all the time. Baseball is a team game, the team sports. I mean, you can't tell me there's not a million football guys that are juicing. Look at what they're doing out there. And fans, you're right, they basically want to watch their teams win, and they'll make excuses and go along with it if they do win.
Dan Shaughnessy, of course, sports writer for the Boston Globe. Dan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Anytime, Robin.
Okay, next week on Here and Now, the man who trained Flipper and has spent his life atoning for that, trying to free and save dolphins now through the fantastic new documentary, The Cove. Also, the guy in charge of the U.S. military withdrawal from Iraq, big moving project, that's next week. Before we go today, redemption and rock and roll. In a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. We leave you today with a story of friendship, recovery, redemption, and rock and roll. Our narrator is Buffalo Tom guitarist Bill Janowitz.
Hey, everybody. Before Buffalo Tom comes out, this is a guy I go back to elementary school with.
That's me, Bill Janowitz, introducing the brave Chris Campion at Boston's Paradise Rock Club. I say brave because opening for a hometown band on a raucous Friday night with a book reading takes guts. But nothing was going to stop Chris. He was in town to support Escape from Bellevue, a dive bar odyssey, a memoir chronicling his descent from life of the party rock and roller to down in the gutter homeless drunk. Brave, too, because it didn't go well for Chris the last time he took the stage here with his band The Knockout Drops more than a decade ago. After ingesting a paranoia-inducing cocktail of booze and drugs, Chris couldn't even remember the words to his own songs.
So my bass player sidled up to me and said, "Sing!" I looked at him, and I looked out at the crowd, and I said, "I don't know, man. I feel like everybody's staring at me."
Yeah, Chris is a bit of a ham. Always has been. We grew up together in Huntington, New York, on the north shore of Long Island. Backstage before the show, Chris remembered the town's great beaches, that famous New York pizza, and, yeah, tons of bars.
The biggest boast is that there was something like 40 bars in a quarter-mile radius.
My dad might enjoy an occasional pint with famous townie singer-songwriter Harry Chapin at one of those bars. Drinking was a social thing in my home, but over at Chris's place, it was like a nonstop scene out of a martini-fueled John Cheever story.
We were either getting ready for, cleaning up from, or smack dab in the middle of a raging party. You know, from the time I sort of cracked an eye into consciousness, it's all I saw. It was everything. I was very caught up in the mythology of it, too. All my heroes, Jack Kerouac, Jim Morrison.
And Ritchie Blackmore, the guy who wrote that guitar lick every kid just has to learn.
You know, dun, 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 dun,
Well, when Ritchie Blackmore moved into our neighborhood, Chris's deliverance to rock and roll was sealed.
This is something I'll never forget. He was like kicking a soccer ball around in his front yard, and, you know, we had like a little conversation, and he said, "Oh, so, mate, you know, what are you all about? What you want to be when you, you know?" And I said, "I want to be a rock star like you. You got any advice?" And his face, like, changed on a dime. He's like, "No, mate, no advice." With that, he picked up his ball and went home.
Chris didn't take Ritchie Blackmore's hint to stay out of rock and roll seriously. I mean, come on. Blackmore, Harry Chapin, Billy Joel, they had these big waterfront mansions around town. It was a siren call Chris and I couldn't resist. We formed bands, started playing clubs. After one of those gigs, Chris got another bit of advice from a club owner who'd seen it all and could see where Chris was headed.
You know, I started drinking when I was 14, you know, drinking and drugging soon thereafter, and he could see that I was, even at that age, just a budding alcoholic. So he was like, "I think you stand a good chance of making it. You know, you got to watch it with the alcohol. It'll rot your liver. It'll take you down." And you know, of course, young guys don't take advice so well.
Not long after that, I went off to college, and Chris went off with a bottle in one hand and a bag of cocaine in the other. And this is the point in Chris's story that breaks my heart. I formed Buffalo Tom, a group that went on, well, if not to stardom, to at least become a God-honest touring band with record deals. Chris built a following in New York with his band The Knockout Drops, only to get slapped down with near miss after near miss on the ladder of, quote, making it in the alt-rock world of the early 1990s. I'd see Chris when we played New York, but no way did I fathom the depth of his problems with booze and the wreckage he was leaving. He was a master at masking his addiction in a nonstop party that only those closest to him were able to see through.
I was like that guy in the bar who you see sort of laughing and then crying in the next instant, sort of like,
"I'm going to kill myself." You know,
that guy. It would always be a surprise to me when they would tell me the next day. My girlfriend, Grace, got it on tape. She played this thing back for me, and it was like, "I hate everything, you know, everything, everyone, oh," this just total foul-hearted rant. Didn't sound anything like me. In fact, the voice was like 3 octaves lower, so when she played it for me, the first thing I said was, "I think that thing needs batteries." And she's like, "No, it doesn't need batteries. This is you."
Chris really did want to die. And after polishing off a bottle of vodka, he called a friend to tell him so. The friend dialed 911 and Chris was whisked off to Bellevue, the infamous New York City mental facility. As Chris writes in his book, "Alone that night, I sat at the windowsill, head in hands, gazing out at the city lights and realized that I didn't know the first thing about how to live in this world." Days later, Chris was released into his parents' custody. He promised to sober up, but he didn't. So in typical Campian fashion, Chris's family threw him a party.
In my family, we call interventions surprise parties. It's like the guy enters the room. Surprise! See that shiny car out front? It's taking you to rehab.
Chris's second trip to Bellevue lasted just a few hours. The idea of another round of detox sent him fleeing down the hospital's corridors and earned him the distinction of being the first person to escape the facility since 1963. Chris found the nearest bar, but in the coming months he lost his girlfriend, his band, his family, and finally himself.
I was at a bar and I was having just intrusive suicidal thoughts. This voice in my head was just saying, you know, why don't you just get it over with, dude? It was just this real geyser of self-pity. So I started praying. I said, God, kill me or fix me.
Well, maybe God heard the fix me part of Chris's prayer. Or maybe it finally hit him that he couldn't go on hurting the ones he loved anymore. But Chris's third voluntary stay at Bellevue proved the charm. Today he's sober and successful with a well-reviewed off-Broadway show, a book deal under his belt, and a watchful eye out for his demons.
Man, when I first got sober, I was clocking every beverage that went by and salivating. I think it took me a while to kind of understand. I still want to have respect for booze because I've seen a lot of people, a lot of friends of mine that have had some time off the sauce start on their sequels. So it's always a possibility, you know what I mean? The phrase ever vigilant comes into play there.
Graveside attendant is what you came back like.
After his reading, I joined Chris for one of his songs, Pilot Light, the lyric of which draws the book to its close. It goes, even though you hide, I think I will keep looking, because if I should stop looking, darkness owns the road.
My soul.
I felt like a proud brother up there. I left Huntington at 16, my friends from that era trapped in a sort of amber of bittersweet memories and simplifications of reality. When a guy Chris and I grew up with was killed in the World Trade Center on 9/11, it wasn't the father or stock trader who died for us, but the sweet, funny kid we hung out with on endless summer days. I had that same feeling reading Chris's book, witnessing innocence lost and then redeemed. That amber trapped boy has managed to keep his pilot light lit.
Chris Campion is author of Escape from Bellevue, A Dive Bar Odyssey. Bill Janovitz is guitarist for Buffalo Tom. He also writes the blog Part-Time Man of Rock. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.